From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, Donald Trump is demanding that UCLA pay a $1 billion fine as a penalty for anti-Semitism on campus. That's on top of $584 million in cuts for research grants that his administration has imposed. But $1 billion? Why not $1 trillion? David Myers will comment. But first, the Danes resisted fascism. We can too. Sarah Sophie Flicker will explain in a minute. Everybody who knows about resistance to Hitler knows about Denmark. The Danes rescued more of their Jews than any other country, 99%. And Jews here learned at an early age that when Hitler ordered the Jews of occupied Denmark to wear the yellow star, the King of Denmark and the Prime Minister rode through Copenhagen on horseback wearing the yellow star themselves. And then everybody put on the yellow star. We're joined now by the great-granddaughter of that prime minister, Sarah Sophie Flicker. She's an organizer who works at the intersection of culture and politics, especially on abortion rights and gender justice. She's a founder of the Women's March on Washington and co-author of the Women's March official book, Together We Rise, a New York Times bestseller. And her new article for The Nation, The Danes Resisted Fascism and So Can We, was number one on the most read list at thenation.com all weekend. Sarah Sophie Flicker, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Like the rest of us, you learned that story about your great-grandfather and the king riding on horseback through Copenhagen, defying Hitler by wearing the yellow star. It's really an unforgettable story.
It is an unforgettable story, and it was some sort of lighthouse for me and the work that I do now. And I held fast to it my whole childhood, my whole young adulthood. And I really resisted researching it because I loved it so much. And, you know, in my household, the story was true. And the few times I was like, well, why aren't there any pictures? Or, you know, it was always like, it doesn't matter, it's true. I think we all knew it wasn't entirely true. And the truth, as it turns out, as I began researching it, is in many ways far more powerful than the myth, because nobody wore the yellow star. Not a single person, not the king, not my great grandfather, who was a prime minister for the beginning of the war, not a single Jew. You know, I'm half Danish, half New Jersey Jew all the way through and through. My parents now live in Denmark. My mom never became a citizen, you know, so being Danish was as animated to me in my youth as being American.
Over the years, you've heard a lot of other stories about your Danish family in World War II. Tell us about your aunts and uncles.
Yeah, and these stories are all true. A majority of just regular people joined the resistance, and they joined the resistance without training, without prior knowledge of how to resist. They just did it, and they did it. They sort of got in where they fit in. My grandfather, he was part of the resistance, and what I was told was that he would sleep with his boots on so he could spring into action immediately. Then I had an aunt who worked in a hospital, and it turns out, you know, hospitals were a major point of resistance in Denmark. You know, they did everything from, you know, fabricating medical records of Jewish people to say that they were too ill to travel. They hid people there. They smuggled information. You know, it was a hub of resistance. And my uncle, Mogens, was a pretty well-known journalist in Denmark. And during the war, he smuggled information, you know, at a great risk. And then he went on to join one of the underground illegal papers.
The only part of the story of Danish resistance that I know is about the escape to Sweden, how on Rosh Hashanah night in 1943, the Nazis ordered the roundup of all Danish Jews to transport them to concentration camps. But a sympathetic German embassy official warned Danish leaders, they told Jewish leaders, and the Danes somehow got almost all the Danish Jews, thousands of them, past SS patrols onto small fishing boats that ferried them to Sweden, 10 miles away, thousands of people. That story is true. But it was only one chapter in a longer history of resistance that you've been learning about, and a history that you think has some good examples for us facing Trump's fascist moves. One of my favorite parts of the story that you tell that I didn't know anything about was the Ten Commandments for Danes.
Yeah. When I finally was brave enough to release the fabricated story, you know, and as Trump took his second term and as an organizer, I thought, okay, I'm going to go against the Danish grain. There's a law in Denmark called the Jantelov, which is like the people's law, which is you don't center yourself. You know, it really frowns upon ego, things that are very commonplace in the US. And that was a big hurdle for me to get over because I was very much raised with that. And I think in organizing, we tend to believe collectively that, you know, it's a group of people that do the best work. And so often it's not a charismatic leader or one special, unique person. So, you know, in researching all this, I stumbled on, it's very hard to find, this story of a 17-year-old resistance member named Arnes, yeah, let's say, I'm probably mispronouncing it. And he wrote down with a pen and paper, I think it's called the Ten Commandments for Danes. And they were just simple, straightforward, basically just don't comply.
Don't work for the Nazis. Don't shop in their stores. Don't believe the propaganda. Protect the people they persecute.
And he made, I think he wrote down 25 copies and he handed them to the quote unquote, like notable members of his little village. And somehow these commandments went viral. Other people wrote them down, you know, eventually printing presses printed them. And I think there were probably posters. I have not been able to find an image of them, but, you know, we do have them written down. I think the one that stands out to me the most is to protect whoever is being targeted. You know, that just is a baseline, I think, that is always important to hear. But also, you know, it's clear from those commandments, this teenager is suggesting little things. Like if you are asked to do something that benefits, you know, the Nazis, or here it would be this administration, do bad work, work slowly, you know, gum up the works, be a grain of sand, grind the whole thing to a halt. And people did that. And we don't have to fix everything that's broken, but we can do one small thing a day. We can do a couple small things a week. We can do one big thing. We can work up our courage after doing lots of little things to do a big thing. I mean, that's how these things work. And so, you know, the commandments feel so powerful because they give us permission to do the right thing.
One of the great things about the Danish resistance is not just that its size, but the variety of institutions that were part of it. When the order came to deport all the Jews from Denmark, the state Lutheran church had a sermon read in every church supporting the Jews. 100% of the ministers helped rescue the Jews, along with, we're told, 90% of university faculty, most of the doctors. You talked about the role of the hospitals in hiding Jews and helping them flee. So different institutions with completely different histories all did a different thing as a part of this resistance. And what about humor? Did the Danes tell jokes about Hitler?
Of course, because fascists hate laughter more than bombs. That's a paraphrase. But, you know, I was really also inspired a few years ago by a book called Pranksters versus Autocrats, which is written about the Eastern European method of creating dilemma actions, which are basically just making wild fun in all the ways that you can of those people threatening to do these harms because they can't handle it. I mean, that's the funny thing about all of this stuff is, you know, basically these are just people with really fragile egos who are trying to assert their power because they don't know how else to feel important. You know, Hannah Arendt wrote about that in Eichmann in Jerusalem. And in, I had read that in college. I do not remember this whole chapter on Denmark, or at least a whole huge chunk of it about Denmark. And, you know, the phenomenal thing, I mean, it like fills my heart every time I even speak about it, that Hannah Arendt wrote about, was that beyond, you know, the things we've talked about so far, there's also this phenomena that I don't know a word for it, but her sort of idea was that the German soldiers, the SS soldiers who were stationed in Denmark, over time, their belief system was run down by this wall of morality that they were faced with every day, you know, be it being made fun of every day, because certainly people were making fun of all this, the soldiers stationed there every single day, whether it was, you know, people asking them, like, how do you live with yourself? How are you doing this? Hannah Arendt's thesis was that over time they started questioning their own morals and their own belief systems, and a big number of German soldiers stopped complying with Hitler.
And you think it's possible that we could do something similar with ICE agents and with local police, that instead of, you know, throwing stuff at them, you say, talk to them, ask them some questions. And what do you suggest this attempted conversation should be like?
There's so many beautiful videos out there right now of people filming ICE agents, of, you know, physically getting in the way of them taking people, of, you know, all these various ways that people are interfering with this machine and trying to grind it to a halt. But the thing that you hear in almost every video is there will be some voice in the background saying, do you have a family? How do you live with yourself? Why are you wearing that mask? What are you ashamed of? If you're so proud of this, show your face. Whatever it is, I think it's part of a bigger tactic. And I personally am a huge fan of the people that are throwing glitter glitter at the ICE agents, because glitter doesn't come off. And, you know, it's a pretty good marker of someone who's up to some serious evil. So
right now, you know, ICE has this huge budget to recruit tens of thousands of new members, and they're having a hard time. You know, they've had to increase the sign up bonus to $50,000. They've lowered the admissions criteria. I asked AI, how can you discourage people from applying for the new ICE jobs? And yeah, I want to tell you the AI answer. Counter the recruiting message campaigns, expose the realities, share firsthand accounts from former ICE employees to highlight the psychological toll, moral conflicts, and public backlash associated with the job. Challenge ICE's recruitment slogan, defend the homeland, with facts about deportation raids, family separations, and civil rights concerns. Undermine the appeal by highlighting career risk. Stress the long-term reputational damage of working for a controversial agency. Emphasize the potential for legal scrutiny. Expose internal issues. Point to the high burnout rates, internal dissent, and whistleblower cases. Share reports of toxic workplace culture.
Wow, AI. I mean, that's like its own set of commandments right there. I have to believe that there's a way to touch people caught up in this stuff. It's so heartening to see this movement building. You know, when I stood on the stage of the Women's March in 2017 in DC, that was beautiful. But I remember thinking, where were you all 3 months ago? And where will you all be a year from now? And I think we're finally moving in a direction that's building, which is the correct way. And I think, you know, we can see the tides are shifting. You know, we can see that it's not simple, and it certainly takes courage. But, you know, like people in Denmark, and I would say people here, it's like, be scared, but do it anyway. And do a little bit, you know, download 5 calls, have that be your first thing that you do. And just, that's a great app that tells you exactly who to call, what to say, on what day. I think that courage is contagious, and inertia is sort of what allows these things to happen. And while, you know, Denmark is so different from the US, it's a tiny little country, you know, there is this history. My great grandfather came up with a term called samfunnsen, which I'm saying totally wrong, but it means community mindedness. And, you know, it's a through line in Denmark, and certainly they don't do everything perfectly. And there's many things that I'm disappointed in with my homeland right now, but there is this undercurrent of we protect each other, we take care of each other, and that everybody deserves equality and dignity. And the, you know, I would say the thing that scares me a little about the US is we have such an individual, you know, of course, like American exceptionalism and individualism and all this. And I think it's time for us to pass that aside for now. We can revisit it and talk about it later. But, you know, we don't all have to agree on everything right now, but we do have to agree that every life is a universe. And that is something that I was taught as a Jewish kid, a Jewish socialist kid. Every life is a universe, and the onus is on us to protect that. And so when I think about the commandments, the Danish commandments, and should there be US commandments, I think that has to be the through line. And there's so many ways that we can take action.
And I understand you're working on a 10 commandments for us right now.
Yeah, it just seemed sort of obvious when I stumbled on the commandments, and I immediately brought them to all these organizers that I work with who I respect so much, and, you know, each with their own area of expertise. And we realized, oh, these commandments are so applicable to the US if we just play around with the language a little bit. And then because we have the benefit of technology, which doesn't always feel like a benefit, but for these purposes, it can be, you know, there's plenty of good things we can do with technology. You know, we are thinking that there could be a QR code that takes you to a resource page with a menu of options where people can, you know, when we think about resistance, it sounds like something you need to know something about, or you need to have studied. You don't. I think about this all the time. I have three kids. If you're a mom and you've organized a birthday party, you know how to organize.
One last thing. The Danes resisted Hitler almost unanimously, and since then, scientists tell us the Danes are just about the happiest people in the world. Lately, they've ranked number 2 on the World Happiness Index, according to the Scientists of World Happiness. This year, the United States is number 24. And by the way, Mexico is number 10, far ahead of the United States. So the Danes are together. They take care of each other, and it makes them happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not perfect, again, you know, and I don't want everyone coming and screaming at me about all the ways that Denmark is imperfect. I'm well aware. But they have a very robust social safety network. And, you know, my great grandfather, Prime Minister Stauning, was the first working class prime minister of Denmark, and he the person that kind of brought democratic socialism to Denmark. And when you have a child, the father takes paternity leave, the mother gets robust maternity leave, a nurse comes to your house with supplies and checks in on you. My dad is, you know, choosing to live the, you know, the last decades of his life there with my mom, and he has some health issues. There are people, you know, begging to come to their house to clean, to do, you know, physical therapy, to drive him to nature, you know, whatever it is. These are things that, you know, we deserve nice things, and and we deserve to live with dignity and joy and equality. And I've been working on the Mom Donnie campaign in New York, and I just, the night of the primary was just such a joyful night, like joy I haven't felt in a while politically. And I just remember repeating to people, like, look, we can have nice things. We can have nice things. And it's, I just hope that people who are socialism dubious maybe take a little time to do some research, because it's actually a really beautiful way to live and makes people feel happy and seen. And they want to take care of each other because that's sort of implicit to the whole system.
Sarah Sophie Flicker. You can read her wonderful article, The Danes Resisted Fascism and So Can We, at thenation.com, where it was number one on the most popular list all weekend. Sarah, thanks for all your work. And thanks for talking with us today.
John, thank you so much. This has been really wonderful.
With government funding cuts to PBS and NPR, tech companies playing nice with Trump, and streamers run by algorithms, what's a reasonable reader of The Nation to do? If you're interested in politically engaged documentaries and independent global cinema, try Ovid with a free month-long trial. The Times describes Ovid as a terrific streamer of independent film fans, and IndieWire praises Ovid for being unafraid to program films that matter. A boutique, hand-curated service with over 2,300 titles, Ovid is home to films by auteurs from Chantal Akerman to Patrizio Guzman to Peter Watkins, with the richest collection of probing, provocative films available anywhere. Sign up at Ovid today and get your first month free using promo code NATION25. That's OVID.TV.
Donald Trump is demanding that UCLA pay a $1 billion fine as a penalty for anti-Semitism on campus. That's on top of the $584 million cut in grants his administration ordered, mostly for medical research. For comment, we turn to David Myers. He's a distinguished professor at UCLA, where he teaches Jewish history. He's written for the LA Times op-ed page, The Forward, and The Atlantic. And he's been an activist working for Mideast peace for decades. David Myers, welcome back.
Good to be with you, John.
A $1 billion fine for not doing enough to protect Jews on campus. Why not $1 trillion? If Trump really cared about anti-Semitism, why let UCLA off the hook for $1 billion?
You're right. By that logic, why settle for $1 billion? To ask $1 billion of a public university is really an act of really breathtaking audacity, but I think it reflects a strategy to dismantle the remarkable edifice of higher education that has been built up so fastidiously and successfully over the course of centuries, so as to further the political agenda of the Trump regime.
I want to go back to the beginning at UCLA, the Gaza encampment on campus. It was in the plaza outside Powell Library. That's what all this really is about. It was up for about a week at the end of April last year. And there was that terrible night of violence. You and I talked about it here right afterwards.
April 30th.
April 30th, 2024. A mob of Zionist militants came from off campus and attacked the encampment. Remind us what happened.
April 28th, which was a Sunday, there was a counter-demonstration, pro-Israel counter-demonstration, directly across from the pro-Palestine Gaza encampment. And already there, saw on the fringes of the two encampments, tensions beginning to boil over. I was present for hours, really trying to separate the two groups. The far greater part of hostility came from the pro-Israel side in terms of what I experienced. And in some sense, this was maybe for some a kind of a testing of the capacity to harass and in the next 2 days actually undertake significant acts of violence against the pro-Palestine encampment, because that's what we saw 2 days later. In any event, what did happen on the 30th is that a group of violent pro-Israel thugs set themselves upon the encampment, tearing down some of its walls, throwing in smoke bombs, beating people with wooden planks as well as their fists. And really remarkably, they were permitted to do so for almost 4 hours without any police intervention, even though there was a contingent of University of California police observing from a distance. It's ironic that what has emerged out of all that we have been talking about so far and will talk about is the allegation of anti-Semitism. I believe that there were acts of anti-Semitism on our campus in the aftermath of October 7th, 2023. And I also believe that there were acts of anti-Palestinian discrimination on our campus after October 7th. What happened on April 30th, 2024 was by far the most egregious act of harassment and intimidation that I've witnessed in my career at UCLA, my 34 years at UCLA, and certainly in that terrible period that began with 10/7.
After the encampment was taken down by the police, a small group of Jewish students and one Jewish professor sued the school. And the Trump Justice Department investigated and concluded that, quote, Jewish and Israeli students at UCLA were subjected to severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive harassment that created a hostile environment by members of the encampment. I'm sure you know this by heart by now, and that this was a violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and also a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, Title VI. I wonder if you agree with that and with the Department of Justice statement that even after Jewish students complained of a hostile environment, UCLA acted with, quote, deliberate indifference towards Jewish students. And that the result is that UCLA is guilty of, quote, putting Jewish Americans at risk.
That wasn't what I observed on campus. And that's not what I understood to be the case as I took a step back and tried to analyze what had gone on. I believe that there were acts of anti-Semitism. The one most memorable one that comes to mind is a papier-mâché pig holding a bag of money and a figurine in a keffiyeh in a cage with a Star of David at the bottom of the papier-mâché statue placed out in front of the meeting of the Board of Regents. So I think there were indeed episodes like that and other instances in which pro-Israel line students were subjected to harassment or required to divert their path to class by going around the Royce Quad. I think those things did occur, and I'm not in agreement with the strategies that were reflected in them. But between that and the claim that there's serious and pervasive anti-Semitism, there's a considerable distance. And that I did not see. I did not see the pervasiveness of it. I saw what I would consider egregious acts of anti-Semitism, albeit very isolated. And the whole narrative of the ongoing, continuous, pervasive, unrelenting nature of anti-Jewish harassment and intimidation is not something that I saw or heard of from the students with whom I spoke. And so I was surprised by the nature of the claims made by the three students and professor in the lawsuit. I was also surprised that there was a kind of conflation between their commitment to Zionism and what they described as their religious faith, as if the two were identical, something which really stood at the center of that lawsuit. And I was surprised, frankly, at some level that UCLA agreed to settle, at another level, not. Insofar as the question of whether there was merit to these claims of serious and pervasive discrimination, I am quite skeptical about that. Insofar as UCLA wanted to put an end to the lawsuit and demonstrate its bona fides in combating anti-Semitism, I completely understand it. The great irony is that hours after the settlement was announced, the Department of Justice issued a letter telling UCLA that it planned to cut $584 million of research funds, enormously significant to the well-being of the university, and for that matter, the well-being of our city and country, because much of that money was going to medical research. So that sequencing of the settlement announcement and then the DOJ proceeding with this massive punitive act against UCLA leads one to ponder what could the possible motivation be, if not something other than combating anti-Semitism.
One other thing about the DOJ finding, they concluded that UCLA allowed pro-Palestinian activists to, quote, enforce what it termed a, quote, Jew exclusion zone, namely the encampment outside the library. Now, my understanding is that Jews were not excluded from the encampment. Lots of Jews joined the encampment because they support Palestinian rights and they oppose what the Netanyahu government was doing in Gaza. So what about this DOJ finding of a Jew exclusion zone at UCLA?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head by calling attention to the fact that there are many Jews in the encampment and many Jews who were in encampment adjacent who felt considerable sympathy with the pro-Palestine movement and may not have been in the encampment. And that, I think, bespeaks the diversity of opinion within the Jewish community around Israel-Palestine and the post-10/7 world. And so often in this discourse that has emerged, the focus is exclusively on those who represent the pro-Israel position. Were people who were identifiably pro-Israel prevented from access, from gaining access to the encampment? I believe they were. Were people subject to questioning about their political beliefs in order to get into the encampment or the ways in which they might or might not behave well in the encampment? I believe they were. Was it a significant inconvenience? Yeah, it depends how you understand significant. But yeah, people had to go around the Roy Squad if they didn't pass, if they weren't willing to pass through the entry point of the encampment. That was an inconvenience.
Now, I understand, though, that this is not the only time that that students have been forced to walk around something in order to get to their destination. There are movie shoots at UCLA often that require
construction. There are movie sites all the time. So was it an inconvenience? Yes, I think it was. Did it amount to pervasive and severe anti-Semitism? My own sense is no, it didn't. Were there acts of anti-Semitism on our campus in this period? There were. Was it pervasive and serious? I don't think that case can be made.
So, as you said, UCLA agreed to settle this case. They paid three Jewish students and a medical school professor $6.5 million, although the money went to all kinds of Jewish organizations, not just to them. And then, as you say, Trump cut federal funding to UCLA research by $584 million as a punishment, he says, for the harassment around the encampment that some Jewish students reported. The medical researchers, of course, who have had their funding suspended, didn't have anything to do with the Gaza encampment, and many of them, in fact, are Jewish themselves. Among those whose grants were cut, according to the New York Times, was Judea Pearl, a UCLA computer scientist, the principal investigator of a $1.2 million suspended grant to apply genetics to large-scale electronic health records. He said, quote, "I've been a principal investigator for NSF for maybe 50 years, close quote. Who is Judea Pearl?
So Judea Pearl is a distinguished computer scientist, a longstanding member of the faculty, father of the murdered Wall Street Journal journalist Daniel Pearl, who was brutally killed in Pakistan by terrorists. And Professor Pearl has been a very strong advocate for Israel, for Zionism, and for the position that anti-Semitism is a very serious problem on our campus. And he himself, I've had some exchange with him, believes that this attempt to shake down the university has no merit. He certainly would like the university to do more to combat what he sees as anti-Semitism. But even someone from his perspective, as far as I understand it, believes that there's no connection between the attempt to fine the university $1 billion or cut $584 million in research grants and the attempt to combat anti-Semitism. It's what I think of as a conceptual non sequitur. It doesn't make any sense. There's no evident connection between the two propositions. It seems, as I said at the outset, to be a case of trying to bring the university to heel in order to advance a political agenda, which is to remove a very significant bastion of liberal democratic values at a time of what seems to be a kind of takeover of the American democratic way, imperfect as it is. But at this point, we should fight for it to the last.
So the governor said the state will fight the $1 billion fine and the $584 million cuts in research funding with lawsuits. But there's also some talk from the office of the president of the university about negotiating with Trump's people in search of a settlement. Of course, Columbia agreed to pay the Trump administration $220 million. Harvard is in court and also in negotiations over a settlement. And the New York Times reported on Tuesday they were considering paying Trump $500 million. But of course, those are private universities with endowments in the billions. UCLA is a public taxpayer-supported school. UCLA argued in federal court in San Francisco just on Tuesday that what Trump is doing is illegal and unconstitutional. And it's the same argument that's been made by dozens of lawyers and found to have merit by dozens of federal judges, that it's against the law for the president to refused to spend funds appropriated by Congress, namely the research funds that he has cut. Clearly illegal. The president just lacks this authority, and the courts agree with that interpretation of the law. But that's going to take a while. The government will then appeal this, and it'll get to the Supreme Court, I don't know, in 2026 or something like that. And in the meantime, 1,800 NIH grants are suspended. Can UCLA wait until 2026 or 2027 for this to be resolved?
Not without paying an enormous cost, and not without enormous cost to the public, which will be, you know, the principal victim of this criminal operation. It's really hard to see how we go on with that massive loss. We will find a way. I will say that UCLA is an aggregation of some of the greatest scholarly talent that I've ever witnessed in my life, at every corner of the university. And people, I think, are feeling at once deeply dismayed by this assault upon such an important pillar of higher education in the United States, and at the same time, quite resilient. We're not going to submit to the attempt to tear down our university.
The LA Times report on the litigation had a subhead, "Negotiation Still Possible." The alternative, of course, is a deal. You referred to the deal that Harvard is about to make. We are told Harvard would agree to pay $500 million, not to the government directly, the way Columbia's deal works, but that Harvard would agree to spend $500 million on vocational programs and research. And in addition, Harvard would see its research funding restored and avoid the appointment of a Trump monitor, important goals. Of course, Harvard has a, what, 60-something billion-dollar endowment. UCLA is a public institution supported by taxpayers through the legislature and the governor. Can you imagine UCLA making a deal like the one Harvard is working on? What would this be? UCLA would give millions of dollars to LA Trade Tech College or something like that?
Well, supporting vocational education is a worthy cause, and I encourage the federal government to do that with the resources that it collects from us in the normal ways, not by shaking down institutions and really attempting to cripple them in the name of this this very patently transparent political agenda. I suspect, given the way things have gone with other institutions, that there will be some settlement. My fervent hope is that it is not at the level of what has been discussed in Harvard's case, $500 million, because while Harvard has a $53 or $54 billion endowment, we have nowhere near that. You know, I also have to say that it's just patently wrong that we are compelled to accede to these absolutely outlandish, audacious, and baseless claims. And yet, in the way things have been unfolding, he has tremendous leverage. He's an enormously powerful president, perhaps the most powerful in all of American history. He's arrogated to himself all sorts of rights that don't belong to the executive. I fear that in this environment, a settlement will be reached and it will be very large. California is a big target. UCLA is a top-rated public university in the United States. It's a win. These are, you know, not just money-making propositions for Trump. These are enormously significant symbolically. If you take down Harvard and you take down UCLA, you have significantly disabled higher education in the United States. It'd be very hard for any institutions after that to resist.
And there's one other problem with making a deal with Trump. We know that negotiating with Trump doesn't end with making a deal. Even in his real estate days, banks stop wanting to deal with him because deals with Trump are just one more step in the negotiation. And the idea that this is a normal agreement where both sides fulfill their responsibilities, this has not applied to Trump in the past. So yeah. I don't quite see where the confidence comes at Columbia or Harvard or Brown or any of these other places that they're actually going to get their money, or that Trump will come up with new findings of new offenses. What do you think?
I have no confidence that he won't continue to litigate over and over and over again and claim violations and therefore withhold funds. He may be a master of the art of the deal, as he understands it, but he's not someone who respects the ethics of deal making at all. Meaning, you engage in difficult, often brutal negotiations, you shake hands, and it's over. And as you said, that's just not the way he operates. And there's something enormously unethical in his version of deal making. And, you know, I would say, I'm not only fearful of the fact that there won't be continued demands made on institutions that have already agreed to settlements, but there'll be continuous demands that there be monitors over the operation of research and scholarship at our institutions. Some institutions have made deals to forestall the possibility of having monitors imposed on this or that domain of their scholarly operation. I'm not at all convinced that that demand will be surrendered, because I think behind Trump, there is someone who has a vision, which is more than just money making. It's really about the opposite of viewpoint diversity, as they so often claim. It's viewpoint uniformity, what the left is always accused of. I think that's really what they're after. And if monitors are an effective way to achieve that, I'm quite convinced that we'll see that in our time. So I have no confidence that the deals that are made, either in financial terms or in terms of the degree of scholarly supervision, intellectual supervision, will be upheld on their end.
You're part of a group called Jewish Bruins in Defense of UCLA that has just been organized. Tell us about this group and about your open letter.
Yeah, so really just a small number of people and I with whom I spoke just this past weekend felt it was important in symbolic terms to demonstrate to the wider public that as Jews, as proud Jewish members of the UCLA community, we do not accept the terms that have been imposed upon UCLA, that in exchange for repairing some broken system that permits anti-Semitism, we should pay $1 billion in fines. We don't accept that paying the United States government at this point in time will do anything to diminish anti-Semitism on our campus or in society. And at the same time, we don't accept that anti-Semitism is raging and rampant on our campuses. So we put together a letter. And here I have to say that our intention was to appeal to people from my perspective to Judea Pearl's perspective. So we didn't talk about whether we think anti-Semitism is or is not a serious and pervasive problem. We just said we find the association made between this request for $1 billion and claims of anti-Semitism on campus to be specious. And we just put the letter out yesterday, and we have several hundred signatories. If people are interested in signing on, if you have a connection to UCLA, you can go to my Facebook page and find that letter and encourage you to sign it.
The website is called Jewish Bruins in Defense of UCLA. It's a Google Doc. Here's the link, sites.google.com/view/Jewish Bruins, one word.
I think it is important that we stand up. We, as Jews, stand up in defense of UCLA.
David Myers, he's a distinguished professor at UCLA who teaches Jewish history. David, thanks for all your work, and thanks for talking with us today.
It's always good to be with you, John.
Start Making Sense, the podcast from The Nation magazine, is recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Jack Merkinson is executive producer. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona, Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com, and you can subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.